There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast
on the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
What are you saying? There's not much to it?
No!
Captain Planet, maybe the Mexican culture is rich with stories upon stories. How the avocado was invented. Where the taco comes from, which coincidentally started off as a separated human hand filled with chorizo meat. Because the Mayans were fucking savages for a long time. Evil. Cruel people.
Quantaquiddle. I never know when we're starting the show.
And we're done. We're in, man.
Oh, we're in the show?
We're in.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel. In studio with me is Marcus Parks.
Hi.
And as always, in a far, far distant location, somewhere in Canada, there's you.
That's me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you finally delineated it. When people said that they get confused about who is Marcus and who is me and who is Ben,
right.
I always think about that. Yes, we are identical.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have separate personalities.
No.
Exactly. And we don't do anything different on the show.
In no way are you the one who poops the most and has the craziest theories. In no way am I the one who keeps it all inside.
Oh, I forget. He's the rational one.
Yeah, it's always weird. You have that reputation, Ben, as the rational one.
Team Trump. Don't even get me started on Donald Trump.
Let's not do this.
No, we're not doing that.
No. Let's go for another rational man.
Oh, my God. Okay, so part four, our first part fourer.
Yeah.
We got to go back to Drifterland, of course. We're talking.
Hey, again, let's get back into the mood
yes.
of Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole, the world of the Hand of Death. All right?
Mm-hmm.
First thing I want to do, you're going to want to do, all right, before we even start, is that if you go to the gym, take those gym shorts you got,
yeah,
right, and just work out inside of them for like a week with no washing, right? Then go take a shit. Like, first, I mean, go get a bunch of Indian food and maybe a bunch of tamales, maybe something Mexican, right? Ooh. And eat it to the point where you're almost throwing up. Then take a rancid shit in the toilet, and while you're taking that shit, smell the shit through the pants. Put the pants up against your own face, all right? And then literally eat an entire cigar. We are now in the mental headspace of Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole.
Right, and take a hammer to a couple of your teeth while you're at it.
Finger a retarded girl. I'm not saying
To be fair to Henry, that is where our story picks back up.
Which Henry are we being fair to?
Both? Neither.
I don't know. There's a fine line between Henry Zebrowski and our main character, Henry Lee Lucas.
That's right.
I'd also say by each chapter of the Henry Lee Lucas story, we can just start talking about how this is two knuckles deep inside of Becky. Last week's episode was just the tip.
Just leave Becky alone. Can we leave Becky alone?
We can leave Becky alone. But you know what? What Henry Lee Lucas says is that he left Becky alone as well. Now, if you'll remember, we're picking back up. Of course, the last two episodes ran parallel to each other, much like books 4 and 5 of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. I'm going to do it. I threw it down.
Yeah. We got a nerd alert 3 minutes in.
They ran parallel to each other, so we're coming back with Otis Toole, heading back to Jacksonville, Florida, and leaving Henry Lee Lucas and Becky alone to travel on to California. Now, we don't know the actual truth about Henry and Becky's relationship, only what certain people who knew them reported.
Again, the idea is we don't know any truth about any of this. Henry Lee Lucas literally lied about every single section of the story. We're going to see this as we go. We're going to get into the confessions. He legitimately, it's because they're wildly different. It's not like slightly different. It's, you know, it goes from I killed 1,500 people in the name of the devil to I killed no one. And then also with the same thing with his relationship with Becky. We're going to see it right here because he says that they never actually had sex with each other because Henry could literally only have sex with dead bodies, which in my head, is it? Which is worse?
Right. That is the funniest defense that Henry Lee Lucas has for not having sex with Becky, is that I just have sex with corpses. So you got their relationship is just slightly more disgusting than Juliette Lewis's relationship with Rodney Dangerfield in the movie Natural Born Killers. If you remember that pair, that sitcom parody where Rodney Dangerfield goes tell her to take a shower,
and get all clean for me.
One of the most disgusting scenes in cinematic history.
Yeah, and from what Henry said, he didn't actually know how to quote unquote love a woman.
We now,
didn't.
What does that mean? Does that mean physically love? Is that like a sex thing? Like he legitimately was like, I kept sticking it in the belly button. But it's mostly what I'm used to, all right, is that when you get a lady corpse, is that you can make the hole wherever the hell you want.
Right.
That's why I like it, because sometimes I like it up near the face. And I know she's got a mouth, but it's just something about making a new one.
Yeah, that's my favorite. Like, you have your, you know, your Leonardo DiCaprio's. You'll never know how to love one woman because there's too many women out there that want him. But Henry Lee Lucas literally didn't know how to do it.
And this is not going to be the last time we compare him to Leonardo DiCaprio.
Now, when I say he didn't know how to, quote unquote, love a woman, It is both physically and emotionally. What he said is that Becky fucking wanted it. He said that she was begging for it every night, that she was dressing provocatively, and that she had grown to be a woman from the little girl that he once knew. But he said that he never once gave in to temptation, even though she would rub on him every night in their hotels. He would always leave. He would be a gentleman. He'd always leave, go to a bar or a truck stop.
Kill a woman,
rape her corpse, and then come back to the hotel, wash off all the blood, and get back into bed with Becky because he was a gentleman.
Oh, I see.
I haven't read a lot of Ann Landers. You know what I mean? I haven't read a lot of those sort of like, you know, manners thing. Is that a gentlemanly thing to not have sex? Again, I guess it's true. You're not having sex with a 13-year-old.
Right.
But you're still the killing rape.
Yeah. That's worse. I'm going to go ahead and make the value judgment here.
You know, it's
worse.
I can't stop thinking that Becky just looks like Honey Boo Boo. And then, like, I just see Henry Lee Lucas as a little sugar bear. And she's like, I will never touch you. I'll just go kill a woman. Henry, you look truly confused on if raping and killing a woman is better than having sex with your child bride.
I'll put it this way, all right? If you...
You're not a judge. We will just say Henry is not a judge in any court of law.
If you give a child bride an orgasm, is that legal marriage?
Illegal. Illegal. Illegal.
Is it still? But what about love, though?
Yeah, we call it
that. What about love?
If he loves her, then he doesn't have sex with her. That's how you treat...
That's what people didn't know, is that song is actually about that. It's about this whole their whole relationship.
You're ruining a 1980s classic, huh?
So by January of 1982, the pair had no car and were reduced to hitchhiking when, outside of Hemet, California, a businessman named Jack Smart spotted the two and took pity on the filthy little couple, picked them up.
Should have been Jack Dumb. That is fun.
So Jack and his wife ran a local antique store. They were always in need of extra laborers because in an antique store, you have a lot of refurbishing to do. Yeah. You have to do a lot of rebuilding on old furniture. So they
a lot of who doesn't work well with fragile antique furniture than a one-eyed, eye-dripping, toothless drifter and his 13-year-old retarded child bride.
Yeah.
Again, perfect. Exactly who you want in the front of the store.
Well, sir, I kind of got a cat's tongue, so I can just lick some old paint off of wood. I can do anything for you.
I don't know. Why didn't they work at like an ice cream shop? You know what I mean? Ooh, like they can really get their charm working.
You go into a Cold Stone and like just a drip from his eye lands on the cookies and cream ice cream. And he's like, I hope they didn't see that.
And he just...
Now, have you seen it? That's 15 cents extra. Some people like it. Yeah. Now, what I've got here has got vanilla, cockroach, and this is tobacco leaves. I like to call that's a Drifter Sunday.
Oh, the Henry Lee Lucas Cold Stone.
They hired Henry as a carpenter, and they gave the pair a small apartment above their store. Mm. And the Smarts, they do say at this time that Henry would sometimes disappear for days at a time. Not even Becky knew where he was.
Because all he had to do was put a fucking blanket over Becky's head and she'd go to sleep.
Like a bird.
Yeah.
But the smarts, they didn't really think much of it because they were actually charmed by Henry. He had a laid-back attitude. He had this hick southern twang, which people out in California, I can attest, actually find southern accents, Texas accents.
Right.
They find them very charming. It's like they like to pat you on the head. Like, oh, right. Look at that cute little idiot. Oh, yes. Look at him. But in reality, they're out raping and killing all over the countryside.
I'm with
Henry. Definitely.
Yeah. I'm with Henry. There's nothing smart about this guy. He's definitely dumb. He's not a businessman. He just keeps shit around his house. Henry Lee Lucas is not a carpenter. He just called him a carpenter. this guy just lives in a fantasy land. He's just a hoarder.
Yeah.
Just Jack Smart. And he's just like, hi, name's Jack Smart. But he's got like pants up to below his nipples. He's got a weird like yo-yo the cartoon yo-yo boy from his yo-yo days where he went to his yo-yo camp. And he's got like a spinny hat on. I'm the first one in my family to graduate from tying shoe school.
So while the smarts, they say that they loved having Becky and Henry around, eventually they got word that Jack's wife's mother, who lived back in Texas, was getting to the point of not being able to take care of herself anymore. Her name was Kate Rich. She was a feisty and independent old widow who refused help from anyone who offered. Everyone knows the stubborn old woman. Knowing that she would not accept any offers of help, her family actually tricked her into taking in Henry and Becky, letting her think that the pair would be dependent on her rather than the other way around.
Right.
They told her that Henry was just a down-on-his-luck roofer and electrician. He just needed a second chance. And Becky, they were totally upfront about the 14-year-old child bride thing. They're like, he's in his late 30s, early 40s. He's married to this little girl, and this little girl, she's great.
He's literally, his blood reeks. He said, I heard him mutter something under his breath about how he could only fuck the dead. And Becky is also, she's got the brain of a tomato, and she's dressed like a toy soldier for some reason. But they think they're going to be great with you in that house, and they will be entirely dependent on you.
Right. And by the way, Becky needs Jesus in her life. And that
remember does. Again, this is also Henry Lee Lucas's side of the story.
Yeah.
This is the hand of death version of this story.
No. This actually came from the smarts. What the smarts said.
You can't trust the smarts.
No, you can't trust the smarts. They called him a roofer and electrician. So far, he's had three jobs I'm not nearly qualified for, and this man's just a mass murderer with one
like
drippy
a year
eye.
Of training to be an
they
electrician.
Just is that what happened in the 70s and 80s? I'm a basketball player. I'm a Pittsburgh Steeler linebacker. And
sir, that's just a dead bird. That's not a basketball or football you have in your hands.
I tackled it.
I'm a basketball player.
Yeah, so whatever.
Nothing but Newt. You know, the Newt, the basketball Newt. No.
It's a net.
Okay. No. Net is what you use to catch whales. I'm a basketball player. I should know.
Yep.
So Kate jumped at the deal because that really the clincher for her was they told her that Becky needed Jesus.
Right.
And so she just absolutely brought them in. They arrived in the rural town of Ringgold, Texas, by bus in May of 1982, a town of less than 100. The Wikipedia page does not mention Henry Lee Lucas at all.
Oh.
And this is actually my part of Texas. This whole saga happened just a little under 2 hours away from where I grew up. The surrounding towns include Petrolia.
Ooh, I love
which
Petrolia.
Yeah.
Named after oil.
Yes. Oh, all the flowers smell like wet oil.
Sugden.
Ooh.
And McGargle.
beautiful, beautiful McGargle, where all the street lamps are just tongues, like in a weird Cronenberg universe where the mailboxes are alive and screaming because they're being punished for being gay in real life.
Right.
When they were alive.
You know, I've actually realized while researching this that all three of us have our very own serial killer in the places where we grew up. Ben,
of
you've
course.
Got Ed Gein, and Henry, you've got Son of Sam.
Yes.
And I've got Henry Lee Lucas.
You can have him. At least Ed Gein was actually a carpenter, and he could actually work with electricity.
Ed Gein had skills.
He was an upholster.
Hey. David Berkowitz was a mailman.
Isn't
he
that
had a job?
Right.
Yes, but Henry Lee Lucas had adaptability.
And Son of Sam could talk to dogs. Magical world that Son of Sam lived in. But he'll be for another episode.
That's where Son of Sam is like Ben.
Yes. Arf, 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 arf. Turns out it wants food.
So Kate immediately took a shine to both Becky and Henry, just like the Smarts did. She saw Becky as a lost soul to be saved, and Henry is just one of the most charming men that she'd met in forever. But the people of Ringgold found Henry and his one eye to be, quote, a bit spooky.
Weird, though. Why?
This is literally the people of Ringgold. If you can put a left shoe onto your right foot, you're the mayor. Like, that's how dumb these people are. And Henry Lee Lucas was the creepy one.
Hey.
The town scientist realized that trees weren't giant, hairy monsters.
They stopped. He's like, don't shoot the trees. You're wasting bullets. Yeah. They're not alive, turns out.
Well, the people of Ringgold, of course, they found them both to be a little off-putting, as they were also just constantly filthy. And they never bathed. They were always just dirty, dirty, dirty people.
Yeah.
But the fact that Henry Lee Lucas was very charming to Kate Rich, but the people of Ringgold just found him extremely creepy, this isn't surprising. You see this in a lot of psychopaths because they only show their real face to people who can do something for them. The people of Ringgold could do nothing for them. So, you know, they got the truck stop treatment. They got the treatment that everybody, every stranger who ran across Henry Lee Lucas got. But Kate Rich got the charm.
What
but,
do you mean the people of Ringgold couldn't do anything for them? They're not just a bunch of Simon Cowells. They're not star makers. They couldn't have put them on the TV. I can't believe the people of Ringgold couldn't do anything for them.
Henry, we got to say all of the townspeople got together and decided that you've got the X Factor.
Whoa!
Go to Hollywood, Texas, where you're going to play the cymbal in the Christmas parade.
There isn't a Hollywood, Texas, but there's a Miami, Texas, which is spelled Miami, but is pronounced Miami.
Oh, so it's extra retarded.
That's very nice.
Not very good.
But he should have put on his charming face for the people of Ringgold because the owner of the general store, he noticed that this drifter and his child bride were constantly showing up and charging beer to Kate Rich's account.
Oh.
Telling them that Kate Rich sent him on a beer run, even though Kate Rich, this old woman who had lived in Ringgold her entire life and was a Jesus-fearing woman, had never once bought beer.
And usually when you send friends on to a beer run, you don't tell them to bring it back inside their body because it's really difficult to get it out. You got to do the whole process.
So the guy that owned the general store, he calls up Kate's family, and they tell him, what they actually tell him is they go, you know what? We're going to sit tight on this for a little while. So they waited for a while, another 6 months or so. It was about another 2 months or so. They waited for a little while. And then finally, the general store called him back. He's like, yeah, this drifter's still hanging around, and he's still charging beer to your mother's account. So they went down.
Because the thing about drifters is that they don't ever fix themselves. You know what I mean? Drifters love being drifters.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it stays comfortable, drifters are going to be there for forever.
Right.
That's another drifter rule, is don't drift if there's free beer.
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect drifting conditions.
Yeah, remember, you don't choose the drifter life. The drifter life chooses you.
I've seen
after you've chosen the drifter life.
Right.
Still.
Mm-hmm.
So the family arrived at Kate's house to find hardened food splattered on the stove and walls, a kitchen sink overflowing with dirty dishes, tracked in mud, covering all the floors, and a smell that mixed sweat with a 3-pack-a-day habit and rotten food.
A smell mixed with sweat, 3-pack-a-day habit, and rotten food would also be the chemical components of a drifter-scented Yankee candle.
Ooh, ooh, where can I buy it?
From any drifter, because he's just got a fucking... He keeps a mason jar full of his physical smell because it comes off of him in sheets in the night.
Oh.
And it hardens. And what you do is you stick a tampon string through the middle of it, and then it becomes the wick for the candle.
And it regenerates itself every 2 weeks, so he's always got some on him.
Yeah, because he scrapes it out from underneath his belly fold.
Isn't that great? It's a good self-made business.
Yeah. So yep. they found Luke when the family walked in. They found Lucas and Becky sleeping on the floor, even though there were couches and beds available. They were sleeping on the floor, sleeping off a hangover. They woke up Lucas. He agreed to go quietly.
I'll go. I'll leave. I first want to say number one. It's been a pleasure drifting with y'all. Here is my comment card. If you would, please give me an A to F. It's not whether or not you enjoyed my stay, but if you felt I lived up to the drifter expectations.
So while hitchhiking to the nearest largish town, Wichita Falls, which is also kind of a shithole in its own right.
Okay.
Henry and Becky were picked up by a preacher named Reuben Moore, who ran a small religious community called the House of Prayer. Unfortunately, the house itself was actually just a real long chicken coop about 10 miles south of Ringgold, where they started off.
I would also now go to say, according to Henry Lee Lucas's word, and even Otis's tool recognition, they're talking about each other's lives. This is supposed to be what Henry considered to be the happiest moments of his life.
Yeah.
We're at the House of Prayer. So take that in mind.
And when you say house, Henry, you do mean chicken coop still.
Long.
Not in the eyes of the Lord. Lord went ahead and put insulation on that house and put a door on that house and put walls on that house and put chairs in that house. That's what the Lord did. In reality, it was chicken coop. But the Lord thought about it, and in our hearts and minds, you could barely hear the bats that would gather at night.
So Henry said, as far as killing goes, that this was perfect cover for him because he was living in this Christian community who, again, totally accepted this middle-aged one-eyed drifter and his child bride.
Right.
Completely accepted them with open arms. And this wasn't like it was the 20s or 30s, like, because out there, living's rough. There's not a whole lot of women to go along with all the men. So back in those days, 14-year-old bride was not the most uncommon thing. This was 1981.
Yeah, but
it's 1981.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. We have like almost the internet.
It's not 1814. Yeah, sure. Nobody knows what people don't know where they were born.
Right.
You know what I mean? They don't know when they were born.
There were Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah.
Everyone had cereal and random other amazing frozen pizzas to eat.
Yeah. I was 5 years out from living 2 hours away from this place. Yes, we did have an inbred family named the Muleys who still live there to this day, still practicing their lifestyle. Yes, that is a reality in 2015.
The McNeelys are inbred.
Right.
That's the truth.
Yes, Holden McNeely from the Round Table of Gentlemen is the
His
product of
were
incest.
First cousins. Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, his grandparents were literally first cousins.
Well, he did a great job sitting in for the live last podcast of The Left Show. Thanks for coming out, and thanks for watching on the live stream.
And thanks to all 1,000 of you. We will be doing that every month from now on. Yes. But back to Henry Lee Lucas. Henry said, as our Henry said, that this was the happiest time of his life because as far as killing went, he could slip in and out of, you know, the House of Prayer, aka Chicken Coop, and go out, kill, come back, and pretty much go unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
It was all going perfectly until Becky found religion.
Oh,
yep.
Every fucking time.
Yep.
Perfectly good drifter satanic murder couple, and she's got to go ahead and sign up with that stinky desert wizard for what? Ruin this lifestyle, this fun? We're living in a chicken coop. How fun is that?
I was looking at a chicken, and I said, "Chicken, if you give me an egg, I'll believe in Jesus." And then, sure enough, chicken shat an egg right into my hands.
Oh, that's not egg. That's just real big shit.
Yeah, it was one of them little brown eggs. I just nibbled it right up.
So, hey, Becky, she'd been congregating with the people at the House of Prayer and was also still making regular visits to Kate Rich, and Becky had decided that her conscience needed cleansing. Now, this is another excerpt from The Hand of Death. This is how Henry said this conversation went. He had just gotten back from a particularly brutal killing spree. When he comes home, he gets out of his car. Becky runs up to him, takes him in her arms, and says,
"Henry,"
Becky exclaimed, throwing her arms around his neck.
"I met Jesus, and he's alive in me."
He kept telling himself,
"This will pass. You just found the cocaine I left hidden in our room."
Becky, technically, she was still a fugitive. Because if you'll remember, Henry and Otis, about a year before, had broken her out of a juvenile detention facility. And she thought that the only way that she could become a good Christian woman was to return to Florida and serve her time. And it took a lot of nagging Henry to convince him to leave the chicken coop and to head back to Jacksonville. And eventually Henry, under great protest, relented and set off back to Jacksonville with Becky, deciding hitchhiking, that's the way to go. But unfortunately, the first...
We've been staying in one place for too long. All right? And yes, technically still it fits your drifter code because the coop does not have walls or a driveway. And so it's still not technically a home. But you know what? It's true. I need my boots need some dust.
Becky is just a modern day version of those Australian girls who went to join ISIS. You know, just if you're 14 and want adventure, just hold on. I promise you, college will be fun.
So the night that they set out, nobody in Texas was in the mood to pick them up. So the two decided to sleep outside for the night. Henry started hitting the ball that he brought along with him pretty hard. He was absolutely furious because they had left the comfortable confines of a chicken coop for this. Right. Two blankets on the hard ground. He said, "We were past this. We didn't need to do this anymore. We had the chicken coop. We had the House of Prayer. It was fine."
But Knuckles, the biggest chicken I met in that coop, was the best friend I have ever made in my life. Mm. And you made me choose. Give me an ultimatum between me and Knuckles. And yes, maybe, just maybe, I did murder Chuckle. I did murder Knuckles 2-3 nights ago and proceeded to eat him. But still, his spirit was there.
Yep. I love Knuckles.
So he told her, he said, "To hell with this. We ain't going to Florida. We're going to sleep here tonight, and the next morning we're heading back to the House of Prayer because we got a good life there." And she, in a Christian rage, opened up her hand and just smacked him. And Henry, possibly thinking back to the abuse his mother had doled out to him in childhood. Or just being a raging lunatic, one of the two, lost control and stabbed Becky right in the chest. And as to what happened next, Henry said,
"Well, I took her panties and bra off and had sex with her. I mean, that's just one of those things, I guess. It's just got to be a part of my life, having sexual intercourse with the dead."
You know what? I can't stop eating sugar. You know, so everyone's got their own vices.
Everyone's got a thing. I still smoke about a pack of cigarettes a week.
Good.
Yeah.
You know, it keeps me fun.
I dip peanut butter in sugar now. Yeah. Call it my adult popsicle.
I don't think that's good, man. Yeah, no. I don't think that's good. Can you still feel your feet?
No, they're turning brown. Some say it's diabetes, but I said, come get me.
So after he was done, he said that he cut her body into little pieces and stuffed the parts into three pillowcases that they had brought along with them. Who knows why?
Yeah, no pillows.
Just pillowcases.
That's never a good sign.
And it's against the drifter code to have anything that's not, to have remote, anything comfortable.
Right.
You're not allowed.
Right.
He took the pillowcases full of the tiny chunks of his child bride and scattered them across the barren Texas landscape. He said it was the only time he ever felt remorse. So, the next morning, after killing Becky, Henry returned to the House of Prayer, just teary-eyed and weeping.
Teary-eye.
telling the congregation that Becky had left with the first truck driver that stopped for him. And Moore, Reuben Moore, the guy that ran the House of Prayer, said later that even though he sympathized with Henry's plight, he firmly believed that the 14-year-old was better off with some random truck driver that picked him up off the side of the road than she was with Henry Lee Lucas.
Let's just put it this way. Becky's, you know the song, "Your Future's So Bright You Gotta Wear Shades"?
Right.
So, Becky's life is the opposite of that song.
Right, no shades needed.
No.
She needs some, like, a flashlight.
Yep.
For her future.
Yeah, we're being picked up by a truck driver on, I mean, and I know, like, these roads, terrifying.
What if the truck driver was Sylvester Stallone and he was taking, to her, taking her to an arm wrestling competition to get his son back?
You want to see me over to the top? I'm about to take this big arm of mine and I'm going up over the top with it.
That's Sylvester Stallone on Quaaludes.
So, Henry hadn't made the same impression on the House of Prayer that he had with Kate Rich.
Weird, though.
Yeah, weird, because you know, Henry said it was the happiest time in his life, but the people of the House of Prayer, not of the same opinion, necessarily.
Mm-mm. Again, it's like the house guest. It's sort of like the movie House Guest.
With Sinbad?
Yeah, where Sinbad got a lot more out of the house than they got from him, and then vice versa. So does Henry Lee Lucas go and teach them lessons about life and love, and like take the teenage son and teach him about dating, and teach the dad about like finding joy in his middle ages?
No,
doesn't happen.
But he does return without Becky and does continue the same lifestyle. You know, and I mentioned Kate Rich earlier. She had heard about how Lucas had returned to the House of Prayer without Becky. Because remember, Becky had been visiting Kate Rich regularly during this entire time. Worried about her well-being, Kate arranged for Henry to take her to church about a month after Becky disappeared. Henry showed up early that day and told Kate, like, listen, I know I'm early, but I just wanted to head over the state line into Oklahoma to grab some beer before church.
Oh, of course. You always drink about, what, 12, 15 beers before church? That's normal.
Absolutely. What's a second pack of cigarettes without a third or fourth thing of a six-pack of beer? And then having to crawl into church because, you know, just so, you know, because it's like, you got to add that smell on top of the incense.
Right.
With your body and your blood stink.
Right.
And your weeping eye. Like, man, you put a great addition to that house. You know what also this also reminds me of, it just cracks me up. It's like Charles in Charge.
Yeah.
There were several plots to movies and television shows in the 80s and 90s about a drifter that just showed up.
Right.
It just made everybody's life better. And everyone just thought that met him just thought that this was the beginning of one of these movies, that he's just rough around the edges.
So Henry, after driving back, he got the beer and started, as he said, started drinking as soon as he left the store, before he even got into the car.
Oh, so he's the world's coolest guy. I didn't know that until now.
Yeah, so he popped open a beer, and on the way back to church, Kate started to insinuate that maybe it was Henry's fault that Becky left.
The guy who went over the state lines before church to get beer?
Mm-hmm.
He was at fault for Becky's leaving?
Well, she was insinuating as such.
You need to tell me that she thought that Henry Lee Lucas, who had blood stink, would disappear for weeks on end and lived happily in a chicken coop,
right,
couldn't keep a marriage together?
She insinuated that maybe it was Henry's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Henry started getting very annoyed at her accusations, and then Kate started insinuating, like, and asking questions like, where's Becky? Like, I don't believe you. She started to say, like, I don't believe that she left with this trucker. What did you do to her? And Henry spun off the road, stopped, pulled out a knife, stabbed Kate right in the side multiple times, got out of the car, pulled the old woman out, and had sex with her corpse.
We're failing to, you just browsed over the fact he did three donuts in a row, perfectly parallel parked his car. It was one of the cooler stops of all time.
Yeah, he did. He did the McGargle drift. Yeah. That's what we should start calling this: this Fast and Furious 9, the McGargle drift.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Except it was he did the parallel park near Lonely Oil Derrick.
Oh,
little Lonely Pump Jack.
Oh, isn't that?
Oh,
just
I thought that was a man named Lonely Oil Derrick. Yeah. Who's just a man covered in oil, being like, I could be rich if only I had a bookie. Mm-hmm.
A nice oil, a nice little oil spout, or as they call them in Texas, a Texas palm tree, which is kind of fun.
So he then, after having sex with the corpse, cut the body into small chunks, as he had with Becky, drove back to the house of prayer, and burned the body in the communal kitchen until there was nothing left but small bone fragments and ashes.
Henry, what you cooking in there?
Kate.
Okay.
Did you say cake?
Cake, yeah. Did I? What was my fake answer? You know what they also will say, too, is that in the Confessions of Henry Lee Lucas, this is a thing where of all of the lies he will tell and the stories he will make up, when they go to this oven in the house of prayer, they will find Kate's glasses in the ashes that where he burned it. So there are these are little connections. Same thing with Becky, where they said later on they believe they found her body dismembered out in the middle of the desert. These are where the weird things of like Henry Lee Lucas was absolutely not telling the whole truth, but there are moments of truth.
Well, he
definitely killed this woman.
Yeah, these are the only crimes where there is any physical evidence whatsoever. Everything else is hearsay, conjecture, and Henry's own confession, which confessions mean jack shit in a court of law.
Did they ever find the bones of Cuckles?
No, because he likes the bones, crimping them and scrapping them, and he keep them in a little bag around his fucking neck because he's like, Cuckles and me will never be apart.
Oh. But about Kate Rich, was she just an unassuming old Christian woman?
Mm.
According to the Hand of Death, Kate was actually hard as nails and capable of any crime. Money was the god of her life, and she'd do anything to turn a profit. The night that Henry killed her, he watched as a young black man dressed like a New York pimp.
Which is just how he thought all black men dressed. Yeah. He was probably wearing a t-shirt and jeans.
Yeah. And a man who appeared to be a banker.
Again, a man with anything but a drifter outfit, which is a leather vest with no shirt on and ripped pants.
And they met with Kate and left late. And after they left, Henry killed her, cut an upside-down cross between her sagging breasts, stuffed her in a bag, and threw her in a culvert.
You don't gotta mention that her boobs are sagging. This is a dead woman.
Well, Max Cole mentioned that her boobs were sagging. I am just quoting the man himself.
Right. I don't think that Max Coleman found women to be attractive.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
And after this, Henry supposedly went on his final spree, heading out to California. Here's how the Hand of Death describes his trip. Without Becky, he was lonely. But his stash of cocaine, LSD, and angel dust gave him some solace. He didn't need sleep.
It always gives me solace.
The LSD would keep him going. With the hot, dry, desert air streaming through the open windows of his car, he laughed and shouted,
I belong to the devil, and no one can touch me!
Whoa! He's like Hunter S. Thompson in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but with no artistic talent or ability to read or write.
No friends.
No friends. But when Henry ran out of money, he found himself calling up Reuben Moore at the House of Prayer for help. But Reuben had already been contacted by a Mr. Hound Dog Conway, the sheriff of Montague County, where Ringgold was located.
I actually think it's a hound dog.
And a trench coat on, like the Gruff.
To give Hound Dog credit, he actually did solid police work in tracking down Henry Lee Lucas. He had dug through Henry's past because, of course, Henry was the last person to be seen with Kate Rich. Mm. So he knew that this man, and he had also gone out to the House of Prayer, and they said, like, well, you know, like, he did have this 14-year-old child bride that he left with one night and came back the next morning, and she was gone. He said she had gone with a truck driver. So he started digging into Henry's past, and he found that Henry had an outstanding warrant in Maryland for car theft. And so he instructed Reuben Moore, tell Henry, it's like, yeah, come on back, Henry. Like, we'll take you with open arms. And so Henry arrived back at the House of Prayer. Hound Dog was there waiting for him, promptly arrested him and put him in jail. And that would be the last day that Henry Lee Lucas would spend as a free man.
I'm going to say
that. Bamboozled by the fucking savior. I'm bamboozled again. God, shorn swoggle. I go up in there and I'm expecting to get some wafers and shit. I'm getting arrested. Yeah, I'm bamboozled.
This is a good day. This is a good day when Henry Lee Lucas finally is off the drifting streets.
Yeah, yeah. This was a very good day for law enforcement and for America in general.
Right.
Yes, the greatest drifter that America had ever produced was off the streets. Now, if you'll remember, Henry Lee Lucas was a 3-pack-a-day smoker and drank literally pots of coffee every single day.
And we mentioned this the last time. And how easy is it to break this man? Unbelievably easy. He was there. He confessed to two murders, Kate Rich and Becky Powell, with all they needed was 3 days of no cigarettes and coffee.
They didn't even torture him at all.
Well, they turned up the air conditioning real high.
Anything a drifter hates is being comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything a drifter hates, cardigan weather.
And he calls in, and he calls up over the jailer on duty, and he says, I've done a terrible thing. I need to speak with Sheriff Conway. And as we all know, the confessions did not end with just those two. When he was going to court to be arraigned, already having confessed and pleading guilty, he was asked if he understood that he was confessing to homicide and would at the very least spend the rest of his life in jail. Henry said that not only did he understand, but he had even more to fess up to. And as we know, the number greatly inflated and greatly deflated over the years. On that first day, they asked him how many, and he said, might as well start with 100.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, let's start there, and maybe it'll go up.
So he just thought of the biggest number.
Okay, how big's the Empire State Building? 100. As big as that.
And so the confessions began. As soon as it got out that a man in Texas had confessed to hundreds of murders, departments not only around the country, but around the world started contacting the Texas Rangers, who were in charge of coordinating all the investigations.
Because now we're looking at what we've seen countless numbers of times before of cops going into close cases on the confessions of this guy, which is one, it's a dichotomy of reaction, right? Because one is that it gives people closure to unsolved murders.
Yep.
It helps families and stuff like that. Because there's a lot of people will die and there's just no – either the evidence has run out or it was just done too quickly or it was too freak of an accident. It was too freak of a disappearance and you'll never know what happened to your loved
one. This is before DNA evidence. The cops got to feel like they closed a case. The families got to feel like they had their some sort of solace and closure.
Yeah.
And Henry Lee Lucas got rewarded with extra steak and random ham.
Yeah, but the worst part was hundreds of murderers went free.
Murderers went free.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, people say, you hear people all the time going like, well, if he wants to confess to the crimes, if he wants to take the rap, then yeah, just let him do it. You know, let him serve the time for it. And that's fucking stupid because every single one of these murders, someone got away with them.
It destabilizes to me the entire meaning of like law enforcement and criminal justice.
Yes.
Because it just shows how it's based on perception and sort of like a subjective truth. Mm-hmm. That, like, it's now coming from basically Henry Lee Lucas's truth took over reality for all these cops and stuff like that. Yes. So it's not the same. It shows to me even more evident that there's no such thing as objective truth. Then how is it? What is innocent and guilty? What does that even mean? anymore. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting here yelling at the fish.
Leave the
what is real and what is fake? Oh, what's a hologram and what is in front of my hands? Am I real?
Yeah.
You're real, Henry, for now.
And so the more Henry Lee Lucas cooperated, as you said, Ben, the better he was treated. He was never without cigarettes or coffee ever again until the end of his days. His cell was completely separate from the other prisoners. He even had a little space that he called his office.
He was living like El Chapo.
And this is what Henry had to say about what happened after he started confessing to the crimes.
It's like being a movie star. You're just playing the part. You know, you don't think of it, you just play it. Make out that you're the worst serial killer in the history of the United States. And that's what I did.
I was at home.
So some officers, as far as Henry Lee Lucas's confessions, and when you watch these documentaries, these like biographies, A&E biographies about Henry Lee Lucas, you have so many officers that are trying to justify these confessions so hard. They want to believe so bad that Henry Lee Lucas committed all of these crimes.
So they have it just opposite of how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be skeptical, but they're just like, I want to believe.
Yeah, but they have this illusion of skepticism where they say it's like, well, you know what? You know, he knew things. He knew certain details about the crimes that, you know, only the killers could know. Mm-hmm. But Henry Lee Lucas was such a skilled manipulator that he could ferret out details of a case from an investigator and feed it right back to him. Like, he could just get those tiny little hints, those tiny little clues.
Yeah, the tiny hints were just like, so you left her in a field next to a tree, right? I was like, I left her in the field next to a tree.
Yeah, and they would, you know, and they would also, when he would take them out on these field trips to say like, all right, yeah, you know, I went out and I buried this body here. And the cops would come out and he'd say like, yeah, okay, so, you know, it was that house right there. And the cops would be like, you sure about that? And he go, well,
yeah, I could get another pack of cigarettes. And,
yeah, maybe it was over there. Maybe it wasn't over here. Maybe it was, you know, and they'd just kind of guide him along until finally he found it. And there are some victims' families that are pissed off, that are actually very angry that these cops pinned these crimes to Henry Lee Lucas. In particular, there's a family in Lubbock where I went to college that Henry Lee Lucas, they pinned this crime on this, one of the most brutal murders in Lubbock history. They pinned a crime on Henry Lee Lucas, pinned this murder on, and the family, they're like, no. We've seen the evidence that Henry Lee Lucas was not even in the state at the time that this murder happened. Right. They're letting this murderer go free. And the Lubbock police, they asked the Lubbock Police Department, they're like, nuh-uh.
Well, they just don't want to hear it. There's a documentary that I watched on ID.
Ooh, Discovery. I love ID Discovery.
Yeah, this.
I do too, yeah. That's my hotel room channel.
Yeah,
it's great. Yeah, really creep out the cleaning ladies so they don't steal your shit. But there was a family of a daughter, of a girl, and they went and they told the sheriff, they're like, we don't think he did it. And they were just like, he did it, man. Please get out of here. They're so mean to the families of these victims.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, not only was Henry able to manipulate them, but he was also heavily medicated during his entire time with the Texas Rangers. When they were bringing in all these people,
they thought he was a psychopath. Yeah. He was a psychopath, so they had him pumped full of Thorazine.
Yeah.
And so he's sitting there like literally the most agreeable fucker on the face of the planet. And then as soon as they detox, because he moved jails, and then he went to the hospital where they didn't put him on Thorazine anymore. And then he immediately said, I didn't do anything. But then at the same time, like 6 months later, he creates the Hand of Death story, which is created in those phone calls between him and Otis Toole. They talk about that all the time. Then he goes on to recant and come back like five or six times up until his death. Mm. And the last things he said, because there's like, when you see the confessions of Henry Lee Lucas, that the audio we played the last time is that place. It took place near the end of his life, where he says, "I never did anything, and I didn't kill a single person, not even my mother." Then it cuts to 2 weeks before that, where he says that his number, his definite number, is 150.
Right. And I was wondering what he was doing in that office that you mentioned earlier in the jail, and he was really working on it. Do not bother me. I will be doing my work in my study.
And even before that, like when it eventually went to zero, there's this fantastic article written for the Dallas Observer that was written near the end of his life, where this journalist talks about how he had gotten he had gotten access to Henry Lee Lucas because he wanted to write about all of the false claims, wanted to write about the families that claimed that Henry Lee Lucas didn't actually do it. And when this writer got a hold of him, he goes, all right, there were three people. All right. That's wow. Okay. So three people. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon afterwards, this writer gets contacted by this lawyer. And this lawyer says, like, hey, you need to come and visit me in my office. I got something that I need to show you. This writer shows up, this journalist shows up, and the guy says, all right, here's what I have to show you. Come on in, darling. And he said, this is Becky Powell. That's what he said. He said, this is, wow, Becky Powell. This is Henry Lee Lucas's child bride, all grown up. And the woman did look like Becky Powell.
Right.
She did. She had a scar on the same place on her face. And she knew things about Henry Lee Lucas that not many other people knew. And so it went on for a little while, and this journalist is starting to think. And what she said, what happened that night, is that Becky actually did get into the truck with the truck driver, and she went off and changed her name because she decided, like, that the whole Christian story, she said, wasn't true, that she just wanted to get out of there. She changed her name, and she didn't even know that Henry Lee Lucas was a serial killer until she saw his face on a paperback in a bookstore years later. And
she went to go pick it up thinking that it was Henry Lucas, just super tiny and sitting in the bookstore. And she was like, Henry, where have you been all this time? You know, kissing the book. It's like, wait a second. Oh, this is one of them paper movies.
So days go by, and this journalist is kind of starting to believe a little bit. And then he suddenly gets a phone call. And this is how far Henry Lee Lucas went with this shit. He gets a phone call from the supposed Becky Powell saying, listen, I'm not Becky Powell. I actually am in contact with Henry Lee Lucas. I read about his story. I got a hold of him. She's one of those women that becomes obsessed with a serial killer and gets a hold of them in prison. And Henry Lee Lucas convinced her to pose as Becky Powell for his own amusement.
Where did you learn this again, Marcus?
It's a great Dallas Observer article.
This highly interesting.
It is. This is amazing.
It's just like, why go so far with the lie? Yeah. Why do that after you already have confessed to so many other things and have recanted back and forth? It's the sign of a true psychopath, right? Yeah. He gets off just on the story.
Yeah, and they actually, in this same article, the writer asked a Texas Ranger, it's like, why is he doing this? And the Texas Ranger said, hey, that's just the way Lucas is. The guy's like a circus that won't leave town.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of time on his hands. So I guess that's sort of the devil's workshop. Huh?
Yeah.
Henry Lee Lucas would have been great on The Moth.
Oh, my God. I'd love to hear his storytelling abilities.
Yeah, and polygraph tests on him were completely useless because they could never tell which of his statements were true and which of them were false.
That's the thing. If you just start lying on a polygraph test, you can manipulate those very easily.
Yeah, that's why they're inadmissible in court. Every single question, like, they tried multiple times. They tried every operator they could to try to trip him up. Never. Not one of them could get it past him.
And so he was sentenced to death. He was responsible for closing hundreds of cases across America. And then when he was finally going to go and could be committed to death, was it the chair or the shot?
In 2005, it would have been the shot. Texas had long since transitioned from the chair.
I think they were going to dress him in a gorilla suit and put him in a Chuck E. Cheese and make him drum himself to death.
I love an ornate death. But he was inexplicably the only prisoner to have his death sentence commuted by George W. Bush during his time as Texas governor.
Yeah,
which is interesting because why? 9/11.
Think about it.
And I'm going to go ahead and put forth two executions that happened during George W. Bush's two terms as Texas governor, or one and a half before he turned it over to Rick Perry. He executed one, Carla Faye Tucker, which we mentioned in our axe murders episode, which he should have been totally down with commuting her sentence. She had, of course, changed to an evangelical belief. She had a big movement behind her to get commuter's sentence. And two, if we will all remember correctly, he murdered a retarded man.
That's right.
Remember.
A black fellow, wasn't it?
A black guy that killed a woman with a pair of scissors. He had an IQ, I think, of 60. 55, something like that.
Well, there's just something about, you know, this man that I see myself in. I see myself in Henry Lee Lucas.
Or was it the long, nefarious arm that was attached to the hand of death that went all the way up to the top of the government and manipulated it so that Henry Lee Lucas would die the only way a true Satanist dies, which is dead in prison from a heart attack at the age of 64.
Right. And you know, the saddest thing about him, he died the exact same way that the toy box killer died.
Yeah.
You know, natural causes should, I mean, I'm not for the state putting anybody to death.
I mean, so Richard Ramirez also died of natural causes. And we got a bit of an, so yeah, Henry Lee Lucas died March 12th, 2001 of heart failure at the age of 64. And I'm sure all of you out there are asking, what about Otis?
What happened to him?
What happened to Otis Toole? Well, Otis would eventually have his own coded to the Henry Lee Lucas story. He would confess to one of the most famous child murders in American history with the death of Adam Walsh, son of John Walsh, who would go on afterward to host one of the most famous crime shows in America, America's Most Wanted. But what Otis says is that he said that he kidnapped Adam near the front exterior of the Sears department store where Adam went missing from after he was asked to leave by a store clerk.
Yeah, they didn't want him there, huh?
They didn't want Otis.
Not good for business.
He lured Adam into his Cadillac with a promise of toys and candy and then proceeded to drive north towards Jacksonville, and Adam started to panic. Toole punched him in the face and it made the situation worse. He just started crying more, and so he walloped him unconscious, as he said, choked him to death, drove to a deserted service road, and decapitated him with a machete. That's his first confession. But he would recant later on, and he was never convicted for this specific crime because the evidence was lost. The cops managed to lose the bloodstained carpet from Toole's Cadillac, the machete supposedly used to decapitate Adam, and eventually the entire car itself. The cops lost a car.
Well, there's a sheriff's son with a brand new car.
Brand new Cadillac.
But also, apparently, the truth is that also Otis had a massive alibi. Because according to him, he was in and out of town. Because the one thing we learned about Otis Toole is that he bought a lot of airplane tickets, apparently. And so airplane tickets had him out of Jacksonville during this crime spree. There was a hazy time, right? Where it's like that was his stomping ground, that whole area, and he was there a lot, maybe doing some murders, so we're not really sure. But apparently during this window, he wasn't there. He was doing something. He was doing his stool breaking job out in the middle of Kansas. And there's just no way to really pin the crime on him, and it's really very fucking sad because it destroyed John Walsh's life. Technically, it gave him a career, which is that fucked up thing of like what's good or what's bad.
Eric Clapton effect. Tears in heaven.
Yeah. And if you watch the press conference that John Walsh and his wife gave after Adam Walsh, because Adam Walsh was missing for like a week, it is heartbreaking.
It's awful.
It is absolutely awful. And John Walsh was actually the main suspect for few days after that. But you can watch, you know, John Walsh, even he doesn't believe that Otis Toole. He's like, it feels like that he feels that publicly he has to accept it. That he has to say, like, okay, yes, fine, this fucking piece of shit killed my son, but you can tell he doesn't believe it.
Right. And that's cops for you. They look at the dad, they're like, no, the dad didn't do it. All right, let's go. Let's go to In-N-Out Burger.
Well, you know what I think I did it is that Carmen Sandiego.
I never know he's
doing something crazy.
We can't find her because I can't get the answers right to the mystery questions.
What is the capital of the Ukraine? Like, who cares? Who even gives a shit? Right.
And here's another interesting fact: Otis Toole, although he was in Florida, also had his death sentence commuted to life in prison.
All right.
Yeah, he was convicted of 6 counts of murder. His death sentence was commuted, and he died of liver failure on September 15th, 1996. And here, one interesting thing about the murder of Adam Walsh, Jeffrey Dahmer was also briefly considered a suspect, but he denied involvement, saying,
"I told you everything. Everything. How I killed them, how I cooked them, who I ate. Why wouldn't I tell you if I did something else? I mean..."
I love it. This is like Dahmer's, like, you know, 70-year-old actor, like Broadway actor. He's like, "What else do you want from me? I've given you my soul on stage."
Yeah. And so, yeah. And what's funny is that Oz died in 1996, but the cops waited until 2008 to announce that the case was officially closed.
Right.
Despite no new evidence coming up, despite them losing the old evidence, it's like they finally got around to it in 2008. They're like, "Oh, yeah, the Drifter definitely did it."
It's awful. It's so difficult to find justice. And if you look to law enforcement for it, you're going to be off and, you know...
Yeah,
you're going to be very disappointed.
Yeah. Sometimes it does work. Sometimes the system does work. As far as like these serial killers go, I think that Henry Lee Lucas is somewhat rare. And in the future, we are going to be definitely doing an episode on some of the actual like super cops out there that do help catch serial killers before they get up to Bundy numbers or to Gacy numbers, especially, you know, the Manhunter guys and John Douglas, those sorts of guys that are actually super cops, and guys like Hound Dog Conway, who caught Henry Lee Lucas pretty soon afterwards. But sometimes you do get, and it does, you definitely do have to draw attention to this, that sometimes cops close cases just to turn that red mark black.
So when also they know this is because, think about this, right? They have a responsibility to these families.
Yeah.
When you're up to a certain point and you cannot solve these crimes, what you're looking for is an out, which I understand, because at this point it's not about justice anymore. It's about providing closure.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Henry Lee Lucas case, this is one of those where the police goof-ups are one thing. It is next to impossible to string together enough evidence to convict a guy like this. Someone who literally says, "I killed bodies on the highway and just dropped them off in the middle of the fucking desert." You don't know what's real or what's not unless you really have unless you do the actual footwork, which will take years.
Right.
Yeah.
To go and track these skeletons down and tie them to people, especially they didn't have the technology. So I don't really blame the cops in this specific instance, because you know, Drifter murders are just, you know, they're the most chaotic. They're the butterflies of the murder world.
Yes, serial killers are the hardest ones to solve, and highway murders, you know, the highways are the killing fields of America. That more unsolved murders happen along the highways than anywhere else in America. Like, they are extremely dangerous, and they are just littered with bodies. And yes, I mean, the cops, you know, a lot of times, but it's like the Lubbock cops. I understand some highway patrolman that's trying to clear some murder that was found on mile marker 234 on I-30 or I-20. Like, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But the Lubbock cops, that shit is unforgivable. They just wanted to close a case. They knew that the evidence didn't add up. It is so obvious. And they still say, like, "Nope, he did it." And those guys, those are the assholes.
I always just say, blame it on the rain. Don't even know what it means, but I just say, blame it on the rain. And in our Super Cop episode, we will be discussing Henry Zebrowski's New York City police officer father, Mr. Zebrowski.
You want a super cop, that's the guy you're looking for.
That's right.
I tell you what, my dad did catch a murderer, a guy that was wanted for murder in 3 states. It was an accident, but he did have to run and grab him. So.
Wow. And awesome. So how is your father's build compared to yours?
We are exactly the same.
That's great. Well, the streets of New York were safe for a couple of years when Pa Zabrowski was walking the beats.
I would say they were a little bit more funny.
Yeah, they were definitely. All right. Well, that's the four-parter on Henry Lee Lucas and Otis. Oh, what an odyssey it was.
I'm so glad. Crazy.
Oh, my God. Thank you guys so much for taking this journey with us.
Wow.
And this was definitely a journey. Yeah, go follow us on Twitter at LP on the left. Ben's at Ben Kissel. Henry's at Henry Loves You. I'm at Marcus Parks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go check out all of our other shows at cavecomedyradio.com/lastpodcastontheleft. Go rate and review on iTunes. Yep. Go join the Facebook group. You guys are fucking amazing. And if you want a Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt that's got our badass logo on it, go again to cavecomedyradio.com/lastpodcastontheleft and get your t-shirt.
And really, you never have to get off of CCR. We've got politics with Top Hat, goofy stories with Roundtable, celebrity Page 7 mm-hmm. news.
Yes, and
Page
mental...
7 is wonderful. That last episode of Page 7 is one of the funniest ones you guys done.
Thank you
that
very so much. Fun. And me and Jackie, Henry's sister, also do a mental health and sex advice podcast. So tune into that one.
Do not listen to the sex and health podcast before or after this. You don't want to tie those things together.
Nope.
At all.
No, you don't. And again, I'm going to keep plugging this just because it means a fucking lot to me for people to watch it. Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. Sundays at 12:15. It's just, we on Adult Swim, we're doing our best to serve Satan well. And we need your Oregon energy. So please, if you will watch it and masturbate, that would be really great.
That's yes. great. And actually, tonight at 3 o'clock in the morning, I will be on Fox News' Red Eye.
Ooh, wonderful. Oh. That will be tonight,
2 o'clock. Yeah.
July 29th?
July 29th,
yeah. Awesome, yes. And also go and buy the Cowman album. It's available on iTunes now. And in honor of Henry Lee Lucas, at the end of this episode, we're going to play a song called Maggie about a lot lizard who ends up dead.
Oh, very nice. Hail yourselves, everyone.
And Hail Satan.
And Heil Gein.
Megustelation.
That's right. Goodbye.
Peace in the Middle East, everybody.
Wait.